I liked Lissa's comments a lot, and in particular, the question I was going to ask before is essentially the one that Lissa asked Noam, so I'm going to put it to him front and center, namely, what's left? In listening to you, I thought you were telling us exactly what I thought Lissa said you were telling us, namely, or maybe I'm stretching her point just a little, but that you were seeking a solution to the problem of linking linear structure to something like meaning, that it was a unique solution to that particular computational challenge. And when I heard you say those things, it sounded to me as though basically you were saying, you know, it's the problem posed by the nature of the task that's determining what universal grammar is. And given that that's what I thought you said, I really do want to know what you think is left for universal grammar.
Well, I realize this is pretty unconventional, but what I believe and was trying to say is that the mapping of linear strings to meaning is definitely a problem, but it's an ancillary problem. It's a peripheral problem for language. If you look at the general architecture of language, the way its basic design is, it seems to me the evidence is, I gave a couple of examples, but it seems to me it's pretty strong that the system is designed to yield a language of thought, interpretation. There's a separate problem. How do you get it out into the external world? And it can be the articulatory system, as Alyssa's shown very well. It can be signed. It can be tactile. In fact, it seems to be modality independent, as far as we know. It comes out differently. There are different principles of organization in sign and vocal speech, let's say. And that, so there is that problem. That's the problem that a child faces. But it's kind of peripheral to language.
So the other interpretation then that I get is that what you're saying is that this discovery was a discovery about the structure of thought and not really anything to do with producing thoughts for the sake of communication. Not about
internet. I think that language is fundamentally a system of thought.
Okay, that's...
That's why I would...
Does that approach differ from that of a generative semanticist who...
Yeah, the generative semanticist had a particular set of assumptions about how a generative process works. It was worth investigating. I think it's been shown that those assumptions weren't correct. In fact, that field has kind of disappeared. But it was a perfectly reasonable set of proposals about the detail. Incidentally, it was extremely rich in its assumptions, very rich operations.
The fundamental concept, again, is that underlyingly, it's the structure of thoughts themselves
that's a traditional view. It goes back as far as you want to go.
Which unifies maybe all of us.
What?
I don't know. I'm just trying to seek a unification here that links the study of language to the study of thought.
It sounds as though
you're with me on that. You're really talking about the structure of thought and not
the structure of thought insofar as it's represented in language. The general question of the relation of language to thought is, well, it reminds me of a comment of Alan Turing's. Everyone's heard of the Turing test, and you know there are competitions every year in which people try to win $100,000 by passing the Turing test. What everyone has apparently failed to do is read the 8-page paper in which Turing proposed this. What he said is the question whether machines think is too meaningless to deserve discussion. So in other words, forget all these competitions, forget everything else, it's meaningless. And he's right. And the reason is because we have no clear conception of thought. And that same problem arises when people talk about the relation of language to thought. And we have some sense of what language is, although not perfect, but at least some sense. We know what thought expressed in language is, but what's thought?
I mean, I thank you for your answer. I should let other people ask questions.
I mean, until some answer is given to that, you can't look at the relation between language and thought. What we can find is that the linguistic expression of thought has certain particular properties. I mean, I mentioned a few. For example, one thing that is interesting about language, I think, is that there are thoughts internally expressible, that are internal to us that we can't articulate because the design of language blocks it. That's part of the argument that language is not an instrument of communication. It's badly designed for communication. It's well designed for a particular kind of thinking, like the cases I mentioned. And they're pretty overwhelming cases. They're not exotic. I would like to make one qualification about Alyssa's comments. She's right, I agree with it, in saying that we want to get rid of the rich detail of universal grammar, which is not, you know, language universals. It's the genetic theory of the language. We want to overcome those rich assumptions. That doesn't make much sense. How could they have gotten there? But it's not a problem of accounting for the rich detail by cognitive processes. The failure so far, and I think it's a remarkable failure, of the investigation of cognitive processes as with regard to language is they don't give us the general architecture. It's not that they fail to give the rich detail. They fail to give the general architecture, the most elementary facts about language, the way it's organized. As far as I know, there is nothing that has been done in what I call the non-existence literature, the study of what you can learn from cognitive processes about the nature of language. You tell me if I'm wrong. I can't find anything. The major studies, the ones that have, a whole endless number of papers, have to do with what's called auxiliary inversion. And I think those are just a total failure. And even if they succeeded, it wouldn't matter for the reasons I mentioned. There are a couple of other examples, like the case of an effort to say something about binding theory. Well, it just collapses at once. There are some cases where cognitive processes interact with universal grammar. I mean, I mentioned one, the alignment of prosodic structure with transitional probabilities gives pretty good predictions about identifying words. That's a question of acquisition, not about the nature of language, and that seems to work. And there are some others, like, for example, Charles Yang, who's done, I think, some of the best work on this, has shown that, there's a book on it a couple of years ago, that you can account for, a problem that's been studied endlessly is the order of acquisition of regular and irregular verbs. Now, this is a standard procedure. The kids overgeneralize, and then they get it straight, and so on and so forth. Now, he's shown you can account for that very well, not in the ways that have been done, but in a different way, namely by integrating statistical procedures with a particular simple principle of universal grammar. Then you get a very good account. Well, there are things like that, but they don't have to do with the nature of language. And I'm not talking here about the rich detail. Nobody knows how to account for that except by lots of stipulations and assumptions. But rather just the general structure of the system, the fact that it appears to be oriented towards a thought system with the externalization secondary and the communication tertiary, just that general fact, seems to be a pretty general property of language, quite far reaching. But even those things seem to be beyond the reach of just inquiry into cognitive processes. I don't see how to bridge that. I don't think there's any way to do it. I think it just comes from the fact that that's the fundamental design of language. And as I mentioned, I think there's, to the extent that you can speculate about evolution, it's plausible on evolutionary grounds.
No, can I ask you a question about...
Yeah.
I was just going to follow up on the structure dependence, if I can.
Oh, sure.
I want to go back to Jay versus Dung, just briefly.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Well, what Jay and Noam were talking about, which seemed like they were in a, they were passing each other in the night. When it comes to using
Rochelle, it's not, she's commenting on Jay and you passing each other.
Yeah, you know, Jay McClellan was on the floor. The externalization problem and the learning problem are extremely complicated. And from the cognitive science side, we care about the behavior, the learning, and the communication. So our challenge is to develop a planning network, or whatever you want to call it, that's constrained by what Noam's talking about, in terms of putting together those components. Let's just talk about speaking, that will output sentences as opposed to something else. And that has, the whole requirement here is to, for cognitive scientists, I think actually the same point that was being made, is to worry about what kind of planning system do we need that takes as input the knowledge system about language, as well as everything else that's related to the sensory motor system in such a way that it comes out as language and you learn it. You pick up the right kind of data that's being used, the use rules that are consistent with the constraints. We don't have that.
Let the panel answer this question.
No.
And then one more question. Barbara, did you want to ask a question? And then I think a lot of people are
having. If I can just make one comment about that. I don't think it's a good idea to sort of distinguish study of language from cognitive science. Yeah, that's kind of like, I think what David was pointing about the auditory system is more a better analogy. They're just different cognitive systems. There's language, there's vision, there's audition, there's mammalian audition, there's bird audition. They're all different cognitive systems. They have their own properties.
They end up producing external stimuli that are consistent with the system.
I didn't understand.
So,
sorry, I didn't catch
it.
Barbara, did you want to ask a question?
Okay. Some of the things I think Alyssa was saying and some of the things that I think Jay was saying, but ask a different question. I think you were both asking, and it was my concern too, how much does the system for expressing and understanding affect the design inside? And you said, I think you answered that by saying language is badly designed for expressing thought. So I wondered if you would consider other ways of expressing or thinking, not expressing thought, but other ways of thinking that aren't in language. A number of us do spatial thinking, and we think you can do a great deal of thinking just that way without words, or without language. And so is there room for another way of thinking that's not language?
Is there room for another way of thinking that's not language?
Oh, sure. I mean, you can't really answer until we answer Turing's question. You can't talk about ways of thinking until you say what thinking is. Okay, we have one piece of what is loosely called thinking that we have some kind of grasp of, not total by any means, and that's what's expressed in language. Well, what else counts as thinking? So I happen to have a couple of teenage kids staying with me now, grandchildren. I mean, they're doing all kinds of things which aren't language, which are very expressive, like the way they take care of their hair and, you know, the kind of clothes they wear and all sorts of other things. I mean, that's expressing all sorts of things. It's very significant to them. But is it thought? Well, you know, if you want to call it thought, it's thought. If you don't want to call it thought, it's not. But not having an independent conception of thinking, we just can't pose the question.
But sorry, I think maybe some of the questions concern, you used the term language of thought, and I think you really didn't mean to refer to thought in the way that Jay and Barbara were asking, but you meant the operations of syntax as well.
No, I mean the thinking that is expressed internally in language. A lot of it can't be externalized, but the thinking that's part of that, like what we do when, what's going on in our heads when we're using, unconsciously of course, when we're using language to plan, to organize, to invent, to interpret, and so on. We know something about it from what's externalized, but there's a lot more that's going on internally, and you can get some handle on it, for example, by looking at unexpressible thoughts of the kind that I was talking about. Well, that's some domain of what's called thought. What's beyond it? Well, unless somebody can characterize what thinking is beyond this, you can't answer it. You can't pose the question. It's very much like the problem that I think Turing's example is a good one. He made, back in 1950, he made a very simple comment, which nobody's paid any attention to. And there's been a huge effort to construct what are called machines, actually programs, to essentially fool people to win the Turing test. They get a lot of money for it. IBM builds big machines and so on. It's supposed to tell you something about whether machines can think. And you get it in the newspapers and the science journals. Turing pointed out in 1950, in the paper in which he proposed this, that the question whether machines think is too meaningless to deserve discussion, because we don't have any concept of thought. So if you want to call, it's like asking, do submarines swim? You can't answer that question. I mean, if you want to call that swimming, okay, the submarines can swim. If you don't want to call it swimming, they don't swim. But it's not a factual question. It's a question of how you want to use the words. You know? And actually, languages differ on things like this. Like in English, in a lot of languages, airplanes fly. In other languages, they don't. They glide or something else. So are the languages right or wrong? No, it's just a question of which metaphor you like. And until there's some independent characterization of what we're going to call flying, thinking, swimming, and so on, you just can't pose meaningful questions about the connections.
I hate to do this, but I think we're going to have to thank the speakers and close the session. So thank you very much.